Okay, I'm going to discuss the neutral gas, the nature of the neutral gas, and the nature of the ionized gas in damp Lyman alpha systems. And they're relevant to galaxy formation because there's compelling evidence that the neutral gas in damp Lyman alpha systems forms the baryon reservoir that makes up the visible matter in current-day galaxies. Ionized gas is more problematic, but it's possible that this is the precursor of the neutral gas. The ionized gas may be the participate in the dissipative collapse of the protogalaxy to make the neutral gas configuration. The evidence for the first point I made, this has been shown many times, but this is the latest plot of, this is the co-moving density of neutral gas from damp Lyman alpha surveys from a recent paper by Story Lombardi and me, a recent preprint, as a function of redshift. And despite the error bars, so that you can see that between a redshift of about 1.8 and 3.3, the co-moving density of neutral gas in damp Lyman alpha systems is comparable to the visible density in current spiral galaxies. And the idea is as you go forward in time, there's a decrease until you get to the current epoch. Now, this doesn't come, the co-moving density of redshift zero does not come from damp Lyman alpha surveys. This comes from 21-centimeter surveys by Briggs and company from Arecibo. And what they interestingly find is that 90% of the gas in these unbiased surveys comes from spiral galaxies, spirals brighter than minus 18.5. And the interesting point about that, these are the same galaxies that make up most of the visible matter in Omega Visible, the galaxies. So the idea is that what we're really seeing is the formation and possible evolution of ordinary spiral galaxies. But we'll see there are a lot of caveats to this as we go on. Now, once these diagrams started appearing, the simulators started to try to replicate this, and this is the latest version of this by Gardner et al. These are tree SPH simulations that I think it's a preprint, and these this is an earlier version of our data, but it's still pretty good. And these are their results, okay, for various models, and they fall short because of a resolution. Okay, they had a resolution of I think of about 100. Circular velocities of 100 kilometers a second. And when they extrapolate using pressure-ejector theory to halos with circular velocities of 30 kilometers a second, then they're able to replicate most of this. So the idea that comes out of this is that most of the mass that makes up the damp Lyman alpha systems really are in very low mass halos. Now, I mean, the problem with looking at gas content alone, you really can't discriminate between CDM scenarios and other scenarios. You can't tell the difference whether what we're looking at in damp Lyman alpha systems are lots of low-mass objects or a few high-mass objects. And the possibility of having a few high-mass objects comes about when one assumes a null hypothesis that you have constant co-moving density galaxies between now and a redshift of 3. And it would be interesting to try to rule that out, even though it's not a very popular scenario. At least it's, I think it's worth testing. Now, it always seemed to me that one way to test between these two possibilities is measuring the depths of the potential wells of damp Lyman alpha systems, because clearly if you have very massive objects, the velocity flow should be larger than if you have very low mass objects. And for a number of years now, Jason Prochaska and I have been attempting to measure the velocity fields in damp Lyman alpha systems with the high resolution spectrograph on the Keck telescope. And what we've been looking at are low ion metal ions, at least we'll start out with that, because you can't use hydrogen to learn about velocity fields in damp Lyman alpha systems. Hydrogen is way too saturated, at least Lyman alpha is. So here is the latest compilation of what we've got. These are spectra of low ions. These are like singly ionized iron, singly ionized silicon, because these ions trace the neutral gas. And what you're looking at are optical depth velocity profiles, and these have been massaged slightly. What I've done here is smooth the data with a kernel of about 10 kilometers a second just to show the large-scale features. And the profiles have been flipped in such a way that the strongest component is always equal, occurs at a velocity less than or equal to the mean velocity. So the things to come away from by looking at this is first that the low ion profiles in damp Lyman alpha systems are multi-component spectra. Okay, that's the first thing. They look very much like the ISM. Secondly, there's a large range of velocity widths going all the way from 20 kilometers a second up here all the way to something like 300 kilometers a second at the largest profile. These are arranged in order of increasing velocity width. And third, there's an asymmetry. There's an edge-leading asymmetry. Once you start looking at profiles, say, wider than the resolution, in about 70% of them, the strongest feature occurs at the edge of the profile. Not in every single case, not here, but in the vast majority of these. So for this reason, a number of years ago, it seemed to us the most natural way to explain this is with rotating disks. Okay, because if I have a rotating disk and I put a line of sight through it, it really doesn't matter where the line of sight penetrates this counterclockwise rotating disk. When I just, and also, not only is this rotating, the gas density has to decrease exponentially, both with radius and with scale height from the plane, you're going to get an asymmetric profile, profile 2 or profile 1. Another important feature here is, and I'll make use of this later, as the impact parameter increases, the width of the line profile decreases because I have a smaller and smaller velocity gradient along the line of sight. So we've tested this hypothesis with Monte Carlo models. The most latest model that we've been using is MoMAO and White. This is a CDM single disk model. And the ingredients that go into this model obviously are the power spectrum, okay, Kreshchekhov theory, and the spherical collapse model. And you just grind the mechanism or the mechanics of these theories through. When you come out with a density of dark matter halos in some mass interval, and what you want to do is convert this into a density in some circular velocity interval, or V200. What I mean by this is a velocity at R200. Now, to convert this to Damp-Lyman alpha, really what we're interested in is the probability of intersecting a disk. What their model assumes is that one has a centrifugally supported disk, hydrogen disk, at the center of the dark matter halo. And I should have pointed this out before, but a Damp-Lyman alpha system doesn't have a physical radius observationally. It has a radius out to a H1 column density of 2 times 10 to the 20. This is important. It's like an isophoto radius in some ways. So one calculates an interception probability, okay, for intercepting a disk like this. And it goes like the scale length of this squared, the density of dark matter halos times the probability distribution of the spin parameter lambda. And another ingredient that goes in here, of course, are the rotation curves. And we just used the prescription that MoMAO and White suggested. Okay, so in our simulations, we just take 10,000 lines of sight and just let them go randomly through randomly oriented disks. And these are the input distribution of circular velocities, okay, that we get. And as expected, of course, it peaks at the cutoff velocity. And we use the cutoff velocity recommended by, I think it was Thule and Weinberg a number of years ago, that halos with rotation circular velocities less than 30 kilometers a second, the gas would, it's photoionized by the extragalactic background, that gas would just expand out and be gas-free. And an upper limit of 300 kilometers a second, because at this redshift, it's unlikely that halos much more massive than that could cool by that time and collapse. This model over here, so these are the usual cosmologies. This model over here is this null hypothesis that, which you can calculate just by assuming a Schechter function, a Tully-Fisher relationship, okay, and a standard relationship between radius and circular velocity. So these are the results, at least for these input parameters that I've just used. And just concentrate on the upper left-hand box. That's the only one that really matters. This is the distribution of velocity widths that we measure. These are the predictions by these various models. And again, as you can see, they really don't reproduce the data because there's just too many objects that have low circular velocities, and you don't get enough velocity width along the line of sight. The only model that possibly works is this Tully-Fisher model that I discussed before, although it's not great. At least it has a KS probability of 13% of being part of the same distribution function. Okay, now, there are other models that have been proposed that also replicate the data. Hanel et al. In 97, instead of using a semi-analytical model, they used a dark matter gas simulation. I think it's a standard CDM. And what's interesting about their model, because they're merging, disks are nowhere to be seen. Okay, you just have protogalactic clumps. And the interesting point here This is one of their boxes, the very high resolution simulation. Everything within the green contour is supposed to be the gas that gives rise to damp Lyman alpha absorption. But the important point is the velocities are not confined to rotating disks. The velocity fields are now in fall and random motion. And as a result, for a clump of a given gravitational potential strength or given circular velocity, you get more projected velocities along the line of sight, a larger projected velocity gradient along the line of sight. So they were able to reproduce at least our distribution of velocity with. They were also able to produce the asymmetry, although I must confess I have never understood how they do that, but it comes out. More recently, Mahler et al. From the Santa Cruz collaboration have had a similar model. I think these are within one galactic, giant galactic halo. One has dark matter clumps with disks associated with this. These are Messel disks. And you can get the line width in this case because the line of sight basically goes through many projected disks and you were able to reproduce the data. Okay. Now, so far everything I've said applies to redshifts greater than 2. I want to turn to redshifts less than 1. And this turns out this is very crucial. And what do the various models predict for the evolution of damp Lyman alpha systems as they go down in redshift? This is sort of a schematic diagram of evolutionary tracks. This is the CDM sector. This is the so-called Tully Fisher sector. In the CDM models, okay, in the protogalactic clump model, by the time you get to a redshift of 1, these clumps supposedly, although these simulations were not carried out to this low redshift, as far as I know, and of course there's a problem, as we all know, with angular momentum, but let's suppose they do. All the models, by the time you have to get to a redshift of 1, have to produce something that looks like the spiral galaxies that we see today. And that's true both for the protogalactic clump model and for the semi-analytical model. And the same is true for the Tully-Fisher model, okay, the null hypothesis that the galaxy distribution at a high redshift is the same as it is today. You just have co-moving density evolution. So the interesting point is that all the models are basically converged at a redshift of 1 for the most part. That spiral galaxies are basically in place, and then they evolve to lower redshift. Of course, to reproduce the damp Lyman alpha statistics, they have to be somewhat larger than they are today, but that doesn't mean their physical size is larger, because it's reasonable to expect that galaxies are more gas-enriched at a redshift of 1, and I'll say more about that in a minute, so that the isofoetal size could be larger. Well, I'm saying that merges, from what I understand, reading your papers, you made the comment that merges basically cease by redshift of 1. Is that incorrect? Right. So you're saying merges still occur at redshifts less than 1? That's not what I heard from Simon White the other day, but okay. I thought you said merges don't occur after a redshift of 1. I remember I asked you that. Okay. Significantly, but it's a small fraction. I think that the bulk, I thought your prediction is that the bulk of spiral galaxies are in place by redshifts of 1. Is that not correct? Okay, but what fraction? All right, okay, we'll talk about it later. Okay, all right. So what is the evidence of what kind of galaxies we're seeing at redshifts of 1. Now, people have been imaging damp Lyman alpha systems at redshifts of 1 and less, and what they're finding is sort of, unfortunately, the sample is very small, but in some cases, one actually does see this. It's very difficult to do this type of imaging because of, well, this really doesn't look too good, but this is the background quasar. This is O235 plus 164. Thank you. And this is work by Burbage et al. And when they subtract the point spread function of the quasar, okay, what they get is what they think is something like a disk-like galaxy with an active nucleus. In fact, I think there's another galaxy over here. There's another object, 3C196, which looks like a disk. But there are also objects that don't look like spiral galaxies at all. They look like a sort of a morphological mess. And Even more extreme than that, Pernshek and Rao recently imaged the damp Lyman Alpha system with a redshift of 0.019 and didn't find any galaxy brighter than about minus 18.5 in the vicinity. So this leads to a paradox because, as I say, galaxies, the galaxies identified with damp Lyman Alpha systems, okay, at redshift plus 1 are a morphological mix, but this seems to be in contradiction to the fact that 90% of the objects contributing to omega gas at redshift 0 are ordinary spirals. So how do we make these two facts compatible? Now, one explanation that Rao and Pernshek gave is that damp Lyman Alpha systems have nothing to do with galaxies, but rather what they are low-mass clouds, what they call giant hydrogen clouds, with masses less than 10 to the 6th. And the reason this might work is that such low masses cannot be detected by the Arecibo radio telescope, okay, at the mean redshifts of Briggs survey. So that you would see them in absorption, but Briggs would not detect them in emission from Arecibo, which is an interesting idea. Or another possibility is that damp Lyman Alpha systems at redshift 1 really are gaseous, but they have low star formation rates, okay, because as, again, Mo, Mao, and White commented that remember that damp Lyman Alpha systems are cross-section selected, so they have higher than the average spin parameters, and for a given amount of mass, they're going to have lower surface densities, therefore lower star formation rates. And, I mean, really, the best way to check this, ultimately, would be to detect the damp Lyman Alpha systems in gas. I think that's the ultimate test to find out really what's going on, that stars are not really telling us the whole story. And this may be possible with the square kilometer array, or maybe even the ALMA array, ultimately. Now, also, the gas content has recently been remeasured again at redshifts less than 1. This is a survey by, again, another interesting result by Rao and Pernshek. And what they did is, instead of looking at a UV-selected sample that was unbiased, they selected objects that had known magnesium-2 absorption, because when it's accessible, every damp Lyman Alpha system that's ever been looked at exhibits magnesium-2 absorption, just like H1 clouds in the galaxy. And what they get disagrees, okay, well, there's really no, I don't want to say they say disagrees. I mean, there's really no statistically, the difference between these two points is not statistically significant. But it's really striking, okay, that in the surveys, this came from the work that Lanzetta and Turncheck, when we were working with him, and I did. We only found one damp Lyman Alpha system in the key project survey, where Turncheck and Rao found about 9. It was really very impressive. And again, they make the point that, that they take this difference seriously, and they say, well, this is a another evidence for a disconnect between damp Lyman Alpha systems and ordinary spiral galaxies. But I want to just make the point that this an enhanced omega gas, okay, by a factor of 3 or 2 or 3 above what we see at low redshift, by redshift of 1, is what one would expect from the ordinary processes of stellar evolution in galaxies that Kennicott was discussing the other day. Okay, in other words, just because of stellar evolution, let's just take SC spiral galaxies, because they contribute most of the gas to the current galaxy distribution today. As gas is, as stars are formed, gas is consumed, so if I can run that process back in time, I can estimate for at least an isolated galaxy what the gas content would be. So this is the gas consumption rate equals the star formation rate times 1 minus the return fraction. And for SC spirals, I'm just confining this now to SC galaxies because they're the easiest, Kennicott has made the point that the star formation rate for SC galaxies has probably been constant for the last 10 gigayears. So I could just integrate that equation and calculate what the average mass over the SC population is at a redshift of Z. I can then go and calculate what the contribution to omega gas is from SC galaxies at a redshift of Z compared to a redshift of 0, and I just multiply that by the average mass of SC galaxies at redshift Z times the comoving density divided by the total gas density. And according to Kennicott, the average star formation rate in SC galaxies for Hubble constant at 70 is about 4 solar masses per unit year. The look back time is about 8 gigayears. The return fraction originally, Tinsley thought it was 0.2, but more modern estimates make it more like 0.5, as high as 0.7. And here's the bottom line. I don't have time to go into all the details, but this is the estimate of, to just take ordinary spiral galaxies, SC galaxies, and estimate what the contribution to the H1 content of the universe is at a redshift of 1. It's somewhere between here and here. Okay, and the most reasonable estimate, it turns out, really is here. This is where the Kennicott's estimate of the return fraction. So it seems to me there's no reason to invoke a new population of low-mass clouds to explain the low redshift Dent-Lyman alpha systems. You can explain the H1 content just by stellar level diffusion processes alone. Okay, so in the time remaining, I'll just say a few words about the ionized gas. I really don't have much time to go into it. One expects ionized gas to be in Dent-Lyman alpha systems if they really are protogalaxies, because gas will be accreted onto dark matter potential wells, be heated up to the virial temperature, and participate in the cooling flow. This is a model of Mo and Meralda Scuta in 96. And in their idea, thermal instabilities break out in the gas, give rise to clouds. And these clouds really are the sites of carbon-4 absorption lines that are seen. What would one expect in this case? As I run the line of sight through the disk and I extend it through the halo, instead of seeing a rotating system, I'm going to see a radial infall of clouds. And the prototype absorption line that one would get in this case would be a double Hund profile, okay, centered on the systemic velocity of the galaxy. That would be to the carbon-4 line, and superimposed on that would be an asymmetric low ion velocity profile. So what's interesting about this is that the difference between the means of these two profiles is, in a sense, a measure of the rotation speed of the object modulo the inclination angle. So what we see is this. Okay, these are the carbon-4 profiles that we actually see in Dent-Lyman alpha systems. And this was completely unexpected. The carbon-4 are the dark lines, the low ions are the green lines. And you can see there is no one-to-one correspondence whatsoever between the low ions and the carbon-4 components. Secondly, the carbon-4 lines are, the median width is about twice that of the low ions. They also have multi-component structure, but interestingly, even though there's no question these are two separate kinematic subsystems, I mean, the probability distributions are just incompatible when you look at the distributional line width, yet they know about each other. They're interrelated because they always overlap in velocity space. That's especially true when you look at these very small line width objects. You know, the low ion lines don't occur here and here. They occur smack on. Let's see. So I'm going to skip all this stuff. So what we've done is constructed a battery of tests, which I think all models have to pass from now on. Okay. Five. And I've already, one is the low ion width. The second is the distribution of high ion velocity width. The second is the difference in the means between the carbon-4 and the low ion profiles. As I said before, that should be a measure, okay, of circular velocity. And just look at, this is that distribution. It has a sigma of about 65 kilometers a second. Again, this is the difference between the mean carbon-4 and low ion. Another interesting statistic is the ratio of line widths, okay? This is the ratio of carbon-4 divided by low ion line width. Except for these two cases, it's always greater than 1. And if, I'm sorry? It's my definition, the central 90% of the equivalent width. Okay, and the third statistic is the cross-correlation function. Okay, what we did, this is the same microstructure. We just take the two profiles, multiply them at different lag velocities, and get a cross-correlation function. So just look at this one over here. This is the carbon-4. And that's what interested me. Even though, you know, the profiles look different, they still are significantly correlated. And that's something else that has to be accounted for. These are the one sigma bootstrap errors. Okay. Just about done. Okay. So when we ran these Monte Carlo tests with these high ions, okay, some of the models passed some of the tests, some of the models failed some of the tests. So what we worried about, maybe we were not looking at the optimal set of parameters. The most sensitive parameters, okay, for these tests are the cutoff velocity, okay, in these CDM models, because almost all the power occurs right near the cutoff velocity. And secondly was the central column density, because remember, as I make the central column density higher, okay, the impact parameters get larger as I go through the disk. And in that case, on the average, the line widths, at least for the low ions, are going to get smaller. Okay. So to finish, what we did is just looked at isoprobability contours in this two-parameter plane. This is the cutoff velocity, and this is the central column density. Okay. And these are the 68, 95, 99% contours. Okay. This is, now, for this case, the probabilities, the chaos probability that the low ion velocity widths of the model are compatible with that of the data. And as you see, what happens is this pushes you up to this part of the plane. And what we're saying here is that when I let D cutoff vary, okay, I'm assuming a model like Deckel and Silt, who many years ago concluded that feedback mechanisms would limit the gas in dark matter halos to velocities less than 100 kilometers a second. Anything less than 100 kilometers a second, the gas would be blasted out by shockwaves. So in any case, the point is, as I go to higher column densities, okay, I have to go to larger V cuts, because as I go to higher column densities, I'm going to larger impact parameters where the velocity widths are smaller, so I need a larger fraction of rapidly rotating halos. And I'll just finish up, finally, by showing you that we really constrain the model with the F-ratio test. Okay, this is the same type of test looking at the contours of F-ratio. Okay, and what happens here, as the cutoff velocity gets higher, the velocity dispersion of the carbon-4 gets higher, so the carbon-4 lines get wider. But I want to keep those F ratios with reasonable values of 2.5 or 3. So I have to have larger low ion line widths, and that means I have to keep the column densities down. But the important point is that these error contours are orthogonal to each other. If I can almost get them to line up. Okay. And basically what this says is that in the CDM model, so basically going to work, if I want to restrict myself to central column densities of the halos, 10 to the 21.5, and circular velocities greater than 80 kilometers a second. And I'll just leave the final view graph up, which summarizes all this stuff, showing which models. And what I'm really saying is here that the CDM models, it turns out, do better than the Tully-Fisher models, because Tully-Fisher models are rotating too rapidly. In this case, that was great for the low ion velocity widths, but it's no good for this comparison between the means of the carbon-4 and low ion velocity widths. Okay, thank you.